Hey, y'all. It's me, Robin. And just real quick before we get to today's episode, if you are loving listening to the podcast, or maybe you don't know because you've just pressed play for the first time ever, but if you like to listen to things in your earbuds, you are going to be so happy to know that Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors is now released as an audiobook. You can get it in Audible or wherever else you get your audiobooks. And of course, you can still get it in print and ebook. If you go to robingoble.com/book, it's going to give you all the options, including that you could order a signed copy from my local bookstore. Alrighty, y'all. Here's that podcast episode you're waiting for.
So when your kid's behavior is baffling, and yours is too sometimes, yeah, I know. Let's take a break from all the bamboozle here on the Baffling Behavior Show.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to the Baffling Behavior Show, or the podcast formerly known as the Parenting After Trauma Podcast. I'm your host, Robin Goble, and oh my word, y'all, has it been a week? I mean, it's been an intense week. It's been an intense month. In some ways, it's been an intense 2.5 years as I've worked and worked and worked and worked with this goal that we finally achieved of bringing Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors into the world. Yes, yes, yes. Finally, we've published Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors. It burst into the world officially on Thursday, September 21. And it's surreal. It is absolutely surreal to say that. Lots of you have already received it because it kind of started shipping, I don't know, basically whenever the retailer felt like it, which was great. I sort of loved the trickling that it did into y'all's mailboxes. That felt better in my nervous system than having this big, you know, hurrah on September 21st. But this kind of like slow trickle actually felt a lot better for me. So I'm really glad some retailers decided to start shipping it even before the 21st. If you've received it, maybe you've had time to already flip through it. If you haven't received it, you haven't ordered it yet, you can, of course, do that from now until probably forever over at robingoble.com/book. Or, of course, you can just put Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors or my name, Robin Goble, into the search bar of wherever you like to order books from. Today's podcast was really fun for me to record, and I hope it feels really fun for you to listen to. If you have listened to the podcast for a while, or you follow me on social media, or you know me in real life, you probably know my dear, dear friend, Marshall Lyles. If you're a little newer to the podcast, this might be your first opportunity to connect with Marshall. And let me just tell you, you are going to love him. Marshall has been my dear friend for what feels like forever, although it hasn't actually been forever. The way that our relationship has grown and evolved, it's just, I think that it feels like Marshall and I have known each other forever. Marshall's a therapist back in Austin, so we met, of course, as colleagues, and then just clicked. Our relationship has grown. He is one of my people. He is one of the folks that I turn to for co-regulation. He's one of my internalized offerers of co-regulation. He is kind and wise and just everything you'd want out of your dearest friend. I'm so lucky to have him. He's also a wildly talented therapist, author, poet, teacher. He is just remarkable. And Marshall agreed to connect with me for today's podcast episode so we could chat just a little bit about what it's like to bring this book into the world. I mean, y'all, the book has occupied brain space for more than 2.5 years, and I really felt like I owed it an episode of reflection. So in today's episode, Marshall and I flipped roles, and instead of me interviewing him, he's interviewing me. Marshall, I knew, would be the perfect person to invite on the podcast and connect with about the book because he knows me both personally and professionally with a level of depth that I'm not sure that anybody else even reflects this way that we're so connected in both of these two worlds. And I knew that along with just him being Marshall was going to allow him to ask curious questions that would really invite me to think about this book at a deeper level. And I wanted to do that for you, but I also really wanted to do that for me. I want this episode to be something that I can look back on in 10, 20, 30 years, and maybe even, you know, my kids or my grandkids could look back on. So I hope you enjoy this behind the scenes journey of kind of like the how and the why and the what of all the things bringing raising kids with big baffling behaviors into the world. Well, Marshall, it's always fantastic to start a Sunday morning off with you. So thank you. Thank you.
I'm always happy to chat with you, friend.
On the off chance there's anyone listening who doesn't know who you are, Marshall is a wildly talented human therapist, poet, artist, and a dear, dear friend living in Austin, Texas, where I lived and worked for 15 years. So, in the last 4 years, sheesh, I've been gone for 4 years, Marshall.
I feel it.
Yeah. You know, you leave a place and you're like, I wonder what's going to happen to these relationships that I can't imagine being without. And here's what's happened. I mean, yeah, I'm so lucky and so grateful and for everything in our friendship and relationship, but also for this early morning chat we're going to have about this book that's come into the world.
Well, I am really excited to talk to you about it. I've loved reading it. And I feel really honored that you would trust me to kind of now get to lead you through a dialogue about it. That feels really, really cool to me.
It's hard to imagine anyone else, you know, that has the kind of combination you have of knowing me personally and professionally. Anybody else who knows me this professionally well maybe doesn't know me so personally, and then vice versa. So we're not prepped for this conversation. I have no idea what we're going to talk about, and I can't wait.
I am real excited. You want to dive in?
Yeah, let's go.
Well, I mean, I know we're going to chat about what's in the book and who it's for and all of those kinds of things, but I think my biggest curiosity is about your process. Now that it's out, it's officially over, what was it like for you going through the stages of creating this and waiting for it and releasing it?
Not as hard as I thought, and significantly harder than I could have ever imagined at different stages. It was... Yeah. I mean, all of the things, you know, there's times where it just felt like part of my workday, you know, something to do. And then there were times where I loved working on it. You know, I loved imagining where it would go, like literally physically, where would it go? There was aspects of working on it and writing it specifically, especially once I hired an editor and the process became a little more relational, that were wonderful. And then there's been parts of it that have been really hard. You know, working with a publisher is fantastic. I'm really glad I had a publisher, but there's aspects of working with a publisher that put me completely out of control of any decision. I don't like that part. Including the timeline. You know, I'd hoped the book was supposed to come out about 5 months ago, and it's been a long 5 months. The extra 5 months I got tagged on.
A big part of my curiosity when I was thinking about your relationship with it was I wondered if it started to parallel anything that's in the book about parents and their relationships with children. Did that strike you at any point?
Absolutely. For sure. I mean, it becomes this, you know, I think everything we do in some ways becomes these, you know, symbolic kind of microcosms of these bigger pieces. And so there are ways, of course, where I can't make it do what I want it to do. I can't make the process go the way I want it to go. I'm completely out of control of anything except myself. And I have been grouchy about the delay in the book, which I totally recognize saying that aloud just seems so inconsequential. And I've been grouchy about it. And there's absolutely been times where I've had to like really just pause and say to myself, like, it is time to move on. Like, it is time to just surrender to the fact that I'm totally out of control of this one part of it. I don't like it. I'm really mad about it. There's absolutely nothing I can do about it. So I can sit here and be really mad about it and let that feeling like then move into other parts of my life. Or I can try to surrender to it and move on. And then, of course, there's been amazing parts of it. And it's gotten more fun lately, which I kind of thought was going to happen, and I'm glad it has happened, you know, as people are starting to get it. And people got it, you know, over the course of about 2 weeks, people started to receive it. It was kind of this trickle as opposed to the book came out and everybody got it, which I thought was going to happen, and I was relieved. That felt gentler to me than this day everybody finally got it, you know? And of course, people have been so generous with their thoughts and comments and feedback. So yeah, these like little moments that are kind of peppered in throughout a lot of hard that help you remember like, okay, this was good. This was important. I'm interrupting the show real quick because if you happen to be a new listener, you might find yourself being a little overwhelmed by all this information. That makes total sense. I mean, there's like 150 episodes plus all the free resources that are available over my website. It's just a lot. So many folks have asked me, where do I start? So I created a separate podcast stream called Start Here. What I did is I took the 10 episodes that I want you to listen to first, and then I want you to listen to in this specific order, and I put them into a separate podcast stream so that you don't have to search for them. You can just press play and they'll play one after the other after the other. If you go to robingoble.com/start here, you'll be able to get an invitation to subscribe, and then you'll be able to listen right in the same podcast app you're using right now. robingoble.com/start here.
Yeah, it's a very vulnerable process to go through, and it speaks to your courage. The amount of bravery to say, I'm going to put my deepest convictions into something black and white for people to interact with. It's anxiety provoking.
Oh, it's terrifying. And I mean, I think there is something to be said for it taking 2.5 years that you're kind of like just slowly over time, it sort of loses that overwhelm of terror that it had. And every now and again, I remember it like, oh, no, people are going to read it. And then all the pieces that kind of go along with that. People are going to review it. They're going to tell me what they think of it. They're going to tell other people what they think about it. They're going to tell the internet what they think about it. And it's terrifying. And then an opportunity. And I don't want to like turn this into some toxic positivity thing. That's not it at all. But I do try to look at these experiences as like, where are they helpful for me in other aspects of my life? And really being deliberate about reminding myself, like, what does really matter here? Like, why did I undertake this process that's been very, very, very hard? And I did not, in most ways, I did not do that for me. I mean, of course, there's some aspects of it that have been very satisfying, but I didn't do it for me. I would have never sustained myself through this process if it was just for me. I would have given it up a long time ago. Like, forget this. I can think of a lot of other things to do. But, you know, I think of the family in some super rural location that has access to, you know, no providers, or the family who has, you know, 4 kids in a varying level of crisis and, you know, cannot navigate all of their needs, or, you know, that's kind of what I keep coming back to is, you know, a book's not for everybody. A book's not the greatest way to reach everybody, but it's a pretty good way to reach an awful lot of people in a pretty low cost way.
That's exactly what I was hoping we could chat about next, is the people who will read it, you know, and where your heart is going as you think about them, what you're hoping will happen for them, even before they open it, what you hope they will get from the title, from the cover of the book. You want to talk more about that?
When I think about it from that, like what you just said, like from the title, from the cover. First of all, titles and covers. Oh my gosh. Like nothing, literally, it was, those were the hardest parts. I'm really bad at things like titles, succinctly describing some. It's just not a skill set I have. And at the same time, the title and the cover, I felt had very strong opinions about. So basically I was like, I don't know what I want, but I know exactly what I don't want. And so if y'all could just figure that out, that'd be great. So, you know, number one, I really was very committed. And so was my publisher to a book title that was not shaming, right? Like I thought about kids who would see maybe their parents reading a book. And I didn't want it to be pejorative in any way for the kids. And I also wanted it to be honest. Like I wanted it to be coherent. I wanted it to like bring honesty and authenticity and like that spirit of like, we can name this and talk about what's really going on without it being negative or shaming to anybody, to the parents or to the kids. And I think that's how I've kind of landed even on the word baffling, which then just sort of took off on its own and people really resonated with it. And I think that's why, is because it's honest and not pejorative. And parents tell me it feels honest about themselves as well, that like, so often they find themselves behaving in ways they can't make any sense of.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
That part, it, is actually one of the quotes I wrote down specifically, is you said at one point something about behaviors make sense, people make sense. And I know that you were in that moment, you were writing it about children's behaviors, but I was, as a parent, was also thinking about my reactions make sense.
Yeah.
And there, it's almost the bottom line existential hope of every human that somebody will look at us and say, your story makes sense.
Yeah.
You make sense. And I mean, that was a literal phrase that I found in the opening words of the book.
Well, I know that believing that for my own self has been probably the number one thing that's changed me, but really what's it's allowed us to like be me, right? That I, you know, the word I would use now for after studying interpersonal neurobiology, blah, 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 I would say like that coherence, like that way of being reflected to of course, everything about this makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And that has changed my life without question. That has been the number one thing that has been impactful for me in my own journey. So, and I imagine ways that I can bring that to parents and kids, and then, you know, kind of secretly to the professionals too, because I know lots and lots and lots of professionals are reading as well. And I thought of them as I was writing, like, how can I help them know that everything that's happening for them in the room makes perfect sense too?
Yeah. I was thinking about who all would read this book? Like, who is the audience? Of course, all parents. Then of professionals would so greatly benefit. You and I both having been through grad school, even though in different disciplines in mental health, we know parenting is not spoken of really in the preparation to be a mental health professional. And that's really scary. But the thing that you kind of alluded to a minute ago that hit me when I was taking some notes is, I mean, the likelihood of this probably isn't dramatic, but I picture a kid at home alone and like that kind of nosy preteen age where you're going through your parents' nightstand. You're going in, like, there was this like holy grail of what will I find when people are away. I'm also revealing some of my big baffling behaviors.
That's not baffling at all.
That's normal. I pictured them like picking up this book, and any page they look at, they wouldn't feel shamed or embarrassed. And I can't say that about a lot of the parenting books that I've read. That I, if I were a kid that saw a paragraph, there would be a sense of inadequacy, or that someone's trying to solve me instead of trying to find a way to love me.
Yeah.
And there's not a single paragraph in this book that I wouldn't feel okay with a kid knowing that their parent is reading. And that is the biggest compliment I could ever give.
It is. So I'm going to just hold that for a second, because that, I might not have put it exactly that way, but that's probably was one of my number one goals. Because, and it is important for that to be true. If, like, if a kid picked it up, I would absolutely want them to feel how I feel about them through the pages. But I also have no idea how I would ever be able to help parents who have their own baffling behaviors. And that's, of course, not criticism, because I have lots of mine too.
Yeah.
If we spent any time criticizing their children, like, how could I ever create safety for parents to, like, really bring me their real, true, whole selves if I didn't just totally embody, like, everybody's behaviors make perfect sense? That doesn't make them good or okay, are not a real big problem, that somehow we got to figure out how to change, because people are getting hurt in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
But And I'll say, I mean, I do think I kind of in some ways stumbled upon that fact. I don't know that I necessarily set out in my clinical work with that overt, explicit intent, right? Like if I can, you know, stay committed to this way of believing about kids and their behaviors, you know, eventually their parents will believe that about themselves. And then that's when really cool stuff starts to happen. I mean, I didn't have that goal. I wasn't quite that forward thinking all those years ago, but that is 100% what has happened. Is there is always a moment where in some way, sometimes super explicitly, in some ways not so much, you know, parents will have a aha moment of like, oh, all this applies to me too. And not only does all this apply to me, but all your compassion applies to me too.
How did you get there? How did you arrive at that place? So a lot of professionals worry a lot about working with parents.
Oh, yeah.
They're not going to be able to meet the expectations. They feel the stress of trying to transition from how to talk to a child to then talk to a parent. They feel, I think, some stress about not being able to provide concrete answers and that being what a lot of parents are looking for and think they need. And yet you seem to just love parents. How did you get there?
I think some of it is really that parents, some of them could articulate back to me exactly that, like, oh, this all applies to me too. And then having that reflected back to me, I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, what an amazing, like, of course that was the path we were on this whole time. And, you know, once it started to be really clearly articulated, you know, then you can see things so much more clearly and then be more deliberate about it, right? So then it becomes part of the process for me. I think there's a part of me that's wildly tenacious, especially for like the most vexing people. And sometimes, bless their hearts, those are the parents sitting in front of us. And I think just like I refused to be a therapist who referred all the kids out when I didn't know what to do with them, I felt the same way about the parents. Like, we have to figure this out because there's nowhere else to send them. And if I want to do this and do this well, we have to find a way to like bring this all together. And then you just get, you know, it's this constant feedback loop of, well, first of all, it makes the work way more rewarding. Like, who wants to go to work and work with people that you're dreading? And that is what a lot of child therapists are doing. They're going to work every day dreading having to talk to parents. And I get that. And that's no judgment against them and no judgment against the parents. They're not these therapists aren't supported in how to do that work. And so, I mean, there's this little kind of like rebel part of me that's like, well, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm going to figure this out. And then you can't help but love them. I mean, in the book, I write, and it's towards the end, Candace Ossifer Russell said to me a long, long time ago, I've never met a true self I haven't fallen in love with. And there's like these career changing moments. And that was one of them. And I just had to, you know, we have to apply that to their parents too. And then again, like the work just gets way more fun.
Yeah.
Way more fun. And the work we do is hard, like absurdly hard. So to find ways where it can be like more fun, more rewarding, more sparks of goodness. And then I think it just reinforced itself, you know, and then parents are telling me nobody has ever created this much safety for me. And that's sort of jaw dropping.
Yeah.
Or I can't find anyone else. And that's also just really, really hard to hear.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how we are, me and you are both this way, right? We're like, oh, there's a problem. I guess it's me that'll solve it. That was a really long answer.
It's a good answer. And it makes me think I was finishing up some writing for something a couple of days ago. And I wrote something like, compassion costs you something. And that's part of in your love for parents, but even how you talk about things honestly, you have a way of revealing that truth that everyone knows. And it's part of the reason why I think a lot of times you read a book, you're hesitant to experiment with the concepts, is because it never feels fully honest or realistic. But you're saying providing safety is hard and it's necessary. You know, doing the work to live in the state of compassion means you have to give up some things, and it's worth it. You know, there's a beautiful way that you are telling the truth without scaring people away from the end goal. And that's what I was really hearing as you spoke through that. And I'm wondering if you would be okay if we chatted about a couple of specific things.
Sure.
In those pages.
Sure. But I do want to say one more thing first, because I think this sounds like something you can remember. We can come back to what you're about to say. And then also it just flew away. Oh, yes. About, you know, compassion is hard. Offering safety is hard. And we got to do it. And I totally get it if you can't. That piece is, I think, in some ways the most important. That, like, I totally get it if you can't. And I'm not judging you. And I can be with you in the devastation of what that means. And we'll just be there together, and I can't fix it. And I get it if you can't.
If we can't find our way to compassion, the first thing we deserve is to give ourselves compassion about that. I mean, it's so intuitive when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
But the lived experience is so much harder because people haven't received that. Very few of us in the places where we run into the limits of being able to show up relationally are met with overwhelming compassion from other people that we can then borrow from.
Yeah.
In later moments, it's not often how life unfolds.
Yeah.
Tragically.
Yeah.
I really, you know this about me. I have a pretty deep love for animals. So anytime animals get brought in, I'm on board. I start seeing animated series in my head. I think in cartoons in some way. So I've been introduced to your menagerie a long time ago, you know.
I love that you just said menagerie. There was a point in writing this book in which I had somebody try to convince me that we should somehow use the word menagerie in the title. And I polled a lot of people. Because my first guess was like, my first gut instinct was like, there's not enough people who know what that word means. I'm not sure I know what that word means. And so I polled a lot of people, because it's not a good idea to confuse people with the title of your book. And alas, like the vast majority of people said exactly what I just said, which is like, I was pretty sure I knew what it meant, but I had to go Google it just to make sure. I love so much that you just use that word.
Yes, I love
my word. Menagerie.
Does it shock you that I love that word?
Definitely not.
I mean, it's very felt, you know, when you're introduced to the owl versus the watchdog versus the possum, it is an immediate nervous system understanding.
Yes.
How did you meet these animals? What's your history with them?
The kids introduced me to them. And then without question, I can think of one in particular a very long time ago that introduced me to their watchdog brain, and in an attempt to, you know, get in less trouble at school, frankly, this one really began the process of noticing the different levels of their watchdog brain, because they had a pretty good, I think, intuition that, you know, we needed to try to figure out how to keep that watchdog a little calmer. So there was a moment, there was a very clear kind of aha moment of like looking at like the work that I was doing with this little one, and then kind of stepping back and being like, oh, this is a lot like Dr. Perry's like state-dependent functioning levels of arousal. Look at that. That's cool. So there was a definite moment of that. But and for sure that particular little one is a very clear spark. And then but they all brought their owl watchdog and possum brains to me in different ways. And some of them use that language because it is so intuitive. And what we know about, well, I love talking about watchdogs because I think it's really easy for most kids, not all of them, most kids in Western culture can relate to the idea that the watchdog is scared but acts scary. That is fiercely trying to be protective. And that's a pretty implicit understanding of watchdogs. And then most people have some sense of the idea of the possum who, you know, collapses to stay safe. So there was, I think, just enough knowledge that kids have through books and TV shows and, you know, things like that, that it was very common, whether it be through storytelling or sand tray or, you know, art or whatever, that there was some kind of theme of these different animals that often came out. And sometimes, of course, the animals would take different forms. You know, there's lots of T-Rexes instead of watchdogs, or, you know, leopards or other like predatory animals can sometimes happen for sure. But for me, that's the best part, because it doesn't matter if it's an owl or a watchdog or a possum. What matters is we're going to make a relationship with these parts.
I love that. I love it so much. I mean, I grew up in an area, you know, where all of these animals were very prominent. Yes. And so they were a part of my backyard experience. But also, you know, two of the three are very active at night, mm-hmm. which has always hit me in a sweet way. And then also, you know, I know you know about me that I have quite a lot of connection to some indigenous roots, and that all of these animals are very represented in indigenous wisdom. You know, it's the simplicity and simultaneous complexity that they get to hold on so many levels just keep coming. And I think that those animals are going to go beyond this book. And there are some beautiful ways that they are going to play and interact with the world. And I can't wait to see what happens next.
One of my most favorite things is when adults start talking about their own watchdog and possum brains. And it happens in the club, right? Like parents will come in and they'll say, oh, my watchdog brain totally took over. And I, XYZ, you know, this thing that they're really judging or criticizing themselves for. But again, they, even inside the like kind of self-flagellation of having kind of, you know, lost it and gone into their watchdog brain, there is already an implicit, but you know, it's your watchdog brain. You're developing a relationship with this part of you, and it's a protective part of you. And even if in this moment that's not coming, you know, up in your words as you're describing it, I know that it's there and I know we can come to it. So yeah, listening to parents talk about it, listening to the professionals, like and being with, and then like my team. Just yesterday, one of my team members came up to me and was like, I would totally watch Dog Brain. And there's just something so perfectly human and delightful and wonderful about pulling in some of this playfulness, pulling in some of the, again, like the ability to like make a relationship with these parts of ourselves that we would normally only talk about in very critical ways. That is so fun. I mean, the kids are like, well, of course kids are talking about owls, watchdogs, and possums. Of course they are. But when the adults are doing it, I was like, oh, this is beautiful.
And you said a couple of times in there, you used the word safety, mm-hmm. Which of course shows up throughout the book so much too. And there's this beautiful way that you're able to describe the subjectivity and really intersubjectivity of safety and trying to find a way to support parents to know that their relationship with their child will start to become the pattern that these animals inside all of us and inside their children start to feel safe with one another or unsafe. And, yeah. And the way that that multiplies and is held both within and without is really well done, because that's neurobiologically a complicated subject that you just found some really sweet metaphors to be able to let them speak without having to fall back into psychobabble in order to try and communicate about it.
Well, isn't that the best part of being a play therapist?
Yeah.
You know, that's like, I mean, I don't know that I found any of this. It really, really feels like it found me. And I think I have some privilege of being able to like listen in a way that's really useful and helpful. And then I know I have an ability people really relate to about being able to take some pretty complex information and offer it in a way that, you know, is relevant and useful for them. So I'm happy to own the parts that I've absolutely, you know, contributed. And also, like, these things presented themselves to me. Like, I noticed patterns eventually. And I'm still noticing them just even recently, because, you know, I'm constantly teaching and I'm constantly in there and I'm constantly hearing the parents in the club use language where I'm like, oh yeah, that's that. Oh, there's that. Like, there's that neurobiological concept that's also implicit in this way of being with these parts of selves that, you know, I wish I could say, yeah, I had the forethought for all that stuff ahead of time, but I didn't. It just really appeared. And I think what I've done well is notice it and then offer it back to people who don't need to talk about polyvagal theory or intersubjectivity or reflective functioning. Like, we don't, it's just unnecessary, right? Yeah. And in fact, the amount of times I actually use the words polyvagal theory in the book are like twice or something. It's really low. And to think about like the whole book is essentially based on, you know, bringing together polyvagal theory with these other pieces. But yeah, I just want to clutter people's brains necessarily with that. But I also very intentionally want us to stay in this felt metaphor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If language, when it's used properly, should only be creating an experience. And if the way it's being used is to create an experience of someone feeling inadequate or confused, then we've missed the point. I think you nailed. I think you nailed that. Do you have it in you for one more question?
Yeah. This is fun.
So we started off talking about who could benefit from reading the book, and to close, I was wondering if you could say how you would hope they would read the book when they sit down to really begin the journey of developing a relationship with it, what are some of the ways that might be helpful for them to plan their journey of relating to it?
Yeah. So I feel like a little story comes up and then we'll maybe lead into that. Maybe my answer will come to me, but I have a very clear memory of pondering how I was going to write this book. And it was relatively early in the pandemic, like midwinter, early 21, like January, February. And I wanted to write a book. I wanted to offer something into the world. It was really clear that my personal and professional life, because of the pandemic and some other things, had shifted in ways it was probably never going to go back to what it was. And so looking for ways to contribute in a bigger way, like writing a book, seemed like it made a lot of sense. And I didn't want to just write another book. Like I didn't want to waste people's time. So there's a lot of really good parenting books out there that are based on the same science. And so I wanted to get really clear that I just didn't want to waste people's time, and I don't want to waste mine either. And I was also, again, I think because we were in the pandemic, I was getting a lot of correspondence from total strangers all over the world that were telling me that my emails and my posts on social media were saving their family. And my podcast had just barely started at this point. So I wasn't really getting that feedback then about my podcast, but I get it now. And I really truly remember, like, on my walking treadmill, like thinking about this book and how was I going to do something that mattered, that didn't waste people's time. And thinking of, like, people are telling me that my emails to strangers, I've never met these people, and I send them emails that take 4 minutes to read, or my social media posts, free. These are free things that people receive from me that I generate quickly and send out to, you know, a lot of people. And I think that really gave me the belief that, like, if I could do that with emails, and that wasn't really even my point. Like, I wasn't sitting down thinking, like, how can I save people's life today? It was like, how can I connect with people today? So it's like, if I did it really intentionally, and I did it in a format that had, you know, more cohesion to it, more story to it, you know, could I do that on a bigger scale, meaning reach more people? And then I also really pondered, like, what was happening neurobiologically, right? It's like I'd spent 15 years showing up in the office, you know, one-on-one clients, one after the other, after the other. And I felt like I had some, you know, based on the theory you and I share, had some pretty good ideas about what was happening. I mean, we'll never really know what's happening and why therapy works, but, you know, we was starting to pretend we had some decent ideas about how that was working. And I was like, but why is it working? Why is that happening in an email? And can I do that in a book? So that, because you know this too, right? The parents who come to us, I mean, sometimes parents come to us just for them and we only work with them as parents, but sometimes I'm just seeing a parent 5 or 10 minutes a week and then they're, you know, with their child and them usually together as well. But it's like, gosh, those 5 or 10 minutes clearly really matter to them. Like, these parents are getting just as much out of their time with me as their kids are, right? And really all of this in intersecting with the pandemic, with the isolation of the pandemic, with the absolute disaster that the pandemic was for so many families, especially families in crisis. There's no services. We've got kids doing therapy online. Like, what? You know? And bless those therapists' hearts who are like, I'm going to figure out how to do virtual therapy. And the kids that you and I work with and the therapists that I know that work with, it's just like, I'm sorry, you're doing what? Like, my point being, these families were abandoned, not on purpose, but because of the circumstances that were happening. And I think at that point in the pandemic, I know this answer is getting very long. Thank you for indulging me. But at that point in the pandemic, we were aware the pandemic wasn't going anywhere. And who knew how long it was going to impact us? Years. And then how we'd recover from the impact. Like, by that point in the pandemic, it was pretty obvious to I think, you and I together. Like, oh, yeah, this whole pandemic thing impacting us the rest of our lives. Our therapist friends were drowning. Parents were drowning. It was just a colossal mess. I also knew, because of my own unique personal circumstances, I was almost certainly not going to go back to doing one-on-one therapy. And I just was like, how can I help these parents? And how can I help their helpers? How can I help the helpers? And I had done a writing project with a writing coach a year previously that had felt a little bit more like a memoir. And there were aspects of that and the way that I was utilizing my own internal dialogue to communicate with the reader that felt really important. And I was like, well, how can I do that in a prescriptive nonfiction parenting book? And somehow from there, this idea of, you know, creating a character and not just creating a character, but creating a character and having me use my like first person voice so that the reader could hear my inner dialogue when working with this parent. That felt crucial for both the parent reader and the therapist or professional reader. So I was just trying to pull together, like, what could I do? This is a book. What do I understand about the neurobiology of change? The neurobiology of co-regulation. I was like, okay, can I really co-regulate people through a book? Well, people are telling me I am through the emails. I mean, that's what people say when they write you and say, your emails have saved my family. What they're saying is, you've co-regulated me through random emails that appear in my email box, right? So I just try to put it all together and think, how could I do that in a book that people could buy for $20 and read wherever and not have a therapist and not have $150 a session and not all the things, right?
Yeah.
So I don't actually even remember what your question was. Okay, how do I want people? So I want people to show up and read the book in exactly the way they need to.
I think
exactly the way. Yeah.
You brought a beautiful word into it while you were talking, the word dialogue. Like, it, as they read it, however it makes sense to them to do that, for them to have the experience of remembering that they're getting to chat with you.
Yeah.
That, you know, this was a sincere, vulnerable version of you and they can talk back, you know. And so I was imagining all the different ways that that could show up of, you know, for people who find help in journaling, like having a dedicated journal beside this, for other people, sticky notes. Just like a little moment here and there. I have this love of transparent sticky notes. Mm. You know, and then being able to put it right over the actual text and then to write back to different things and add adjectives and to draw hearts around. And so I was feeling like a playful, I was imagining for the more artistically minded, like the kind of art that they could create as they're reading through this book. I was imagining book groups and people then taking dialogue. I just started realizing you've created this in a way that however people need to be with it. And, you know, if I could have an agenda, which I try not to, but I'm going to have one here, is it's a very bingeable book. And so for people who like to binge, I hope they do, but I hope they then go back and read it slow. Yeah. You know, Bonnie in her foreword says something a little bit about that, of just make sure that you digest this as you go, because there's so much waiting for you. But I think your answer is beautiful in that what that dialogue needs to look like for people and the way that they accomplish that gets to be as individual as the book reminds us that people are.
Yes. Yes. And that it'll be different for everyone and there'll be no right or wrong. And I trust people. Like, I trust the way they interact with it to be exactly what they need. And I'm going to work really hard to trust that, to be, trust that even if people hate it, which feels really hard. But, but again, like, to walk my walk, it's like, if that's what someone needs out of that experience, then I'm so honored to give that to them and be a part of, what they needed. And there are times where I feel a little icky saying, I hope people internalize me. It's like, it's uncomfortable. Is that arrogant? Is that egotistical? But then I kind of come back to, like, I actually don't care that it's me. I could care less who it is. I just happen to know me the best.
So, yeah.
So, like, if I don't care who they internalize, as long as it's a voice of all behavior makes sense. And I adore you. And you're as perfectly precious and not broken as your kid. Mm. Only good things can come from that.
That seems like the perfect button for this conversation. I'm proud of you, friend. I mean, you did something phenomenal. You did something vulnerable. You did something very honest, and you produced something that we all need. So thank you for writing it, and thank you for inviting me to get to chat with you about it.
Thank you for being who I've internalized, a part of that group, so that I can, show up in the world in this way and offer this to these people. So very grateful for you and our friendship.
Same here. Let's see where this takes you next.
I can't wait. It'll be fun. Well, y'all, that became something I could have never anticipated or scripted or, known. So I just appreciate in so many ways your willingness to witness me and my experience with not just writing this book, but writing it for you. And of course, for me. I mean, we can't pull that part out of it, but, in every step of the way, I tried to really, really stay focused on what my, end game was and who I was writing for. And I'm really grateful if you've listened this long and you took the time to really witness my experience with this book. Thank you for everything. Thank you for showing up here. Thank you for loving kids with vulnerable nervous systems and big baffling behaviors and doing this in an attempt to help the world, help ourselves understand these kids. And understand ourselves better too. We'll be back next week and I can't wait to be with you then. Are you ending this episode with maybe a big sigh of relief? Like, yes, finally, someone gets me and my kids. But also maybe a sense of like, okay, but now what? All right, y'all, I've got lots of possible now whats. If you want to connect with me directly, like pick my brain, have access to me almost every day, not to mention hundreds of other parents from around the world who totally get what it's like to be you, then you're going to want to join us in the club. We have monthly live events, including groups for siblings of dysregulated kids, a huge video library with something like 80 or 90 videos, plus transcripts and certificates of completion. Plus, of course, a very active forum that I'm participating in every single day. We open for new members periodically, so go check robingoble.com/the club. If we aren't open now, you can put yourself on the waiting list and I'll let you know the moment we open for new members. That's robingoble.com/the club. Now, if you're a professional and you want to strengthen your capacity to work with the families of kids with big baffling behaviors and vulnerable nervous systems, plus use all of my materials, including a 12-module course that follows raising kids with big baffling behaviors, plus be included in an online searchable directory so families all over the world could find you, then you're looking for Being With, which is my year-long immersive training program that runs January through December. So you'll want to go to robingoble.com/beingwith, read all about it, and if you're interested, put yourself on that waiting list too. Now, if you just maybe need a little extra connection and co-regulation, but don't feel like you need to join the club, then you can just keep listening to my podcast, or you could go subscribe to my Start Here podcast, and that'll give you 10 episodes in order that will take you through cultivating a great foundation of parenting with regulation, connection, and felt safety. That's at robingoble.com/start here. You have to go there. You can't just find it in your podcast app. Or you could get yourself a copy of Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors, paper book, audio book, ebook. You can get that anywhere books are sold. Or you could just head to my website, download one of my very many free resources. I keep them all really easy to access at robingoble.com/free resources. Webinars, masterclasses, ebooks, infographics, all sorts of stuff. Go check it out. See what of those things could be supportive of you or maybe to the other adults in your life who are helping support you and your child. There are just so many ways that you and I could be more connected, and you can get the amount of co-regulation and support that you need. If it feels like a lot to remember, all you have to do is go to robingoble.com and take your time clicking around, seeing what I got there. I am so, so glad you and I are connected now, and I can't wait to be with you again soon in our next episode of the Baffling Behavior Show. Bye-bye, y'all.